Hello, and welcome to Energy Central Insights, the official podcast of Energy Central. Located in New York City, I'm your host, Jason Price, Community Engagement Ambassador for Energy Central. Joining is my colleague, Matt Chester, Community Manager, located in Orlando, Florida. Hi, Matt.
Thanks, Jason. Really excited to kick off this podcast anew with you. We have so many great minds across the Energy Central community that it's going to be terrific to have yet another avenue to share their insights and expertise with the wider utility industry. So thanks for kicking this new venture off with us, and let's get started.
Agreed. It's my pleasure. So since 1995, Energy Central has been a trusted news and information source for professionals working in the power industry. Today, Energy Central is more than just a news source. Energy Central is a network of community groups focused on specific topics in the industry. Our managed communities are a place where professionals like you can come together to share, learn, and connect in a collaborative environment. We invite you to become a member, if you haven't already, and join over 200,000 other professionals working in the power industry. To join, visit www.energycentral.com, and membership is free. For our listeners, welcome to our inaugural show, and thank you for joining us. The Energy Central Insights format is simple. You, the Energy Central community, determine our guests based on the most popular, timely, and relevant articles posted by our community members. For anyone posting in the community, be prepared. You may be the next one asked to join us on the podcast stage to discuss your work, your ideas, and your perspective. So, who garnered the most interest to deserve the title as guest of honor for this maiden voyage? I feel privileged to introduce Dan Yerman. Dan has been a member of Energy Central for many years. He has over 930 posts, over 280 comments, and garnered over 450,000 views. He has indeed built a following on Energy Central, and he's also registered as part of the Energy Central's official network of experts. If you follow the nuclear energy industry or have come across a major nuclear energy infrastructure project in the U.S., Asia, Middle East, or Europe, then you likely have experienced the work of Dan Yerman. His career began in 1979 at the Environmental Protection Agency, then moved on to important positions at the Idaho National Lab, Bechtel, Rockwell Automation, and NASA. He is a prolific writer on Energy Central, as well as his own blog, Neutron Bytes, and that's Byte, B-Y-T-E-S. Please welcome my guest, our first guest for Energy Central Insights, Dan Yerman.
Thank you very much, Jason, for that very, very nice introduction. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Dan, before we dig into things, let me explain to our listeners what brought you to our attention. In good spirit to the holiday season, on November 14th, 2019, you published Dan's Idaho Nuclear Chili Recipe. The popularity of this article suggests that either this recipe is off the charts, perhaps gone nuclear, or we have a hungry readership on Energy Central, or both. Dan, tell us the inception of this recipe and why you think it garnered such popularity for our readers.
Well, I developed the recipe in Idaho when I was working at the Idaho National Lab. I was there from 1989 to 2009. I worked out in the desert, and it gets pretty cold out there. I don't see zero from the high from around the middle of December to the end of February. So you want hot stuff to eat, and chili is a good place to start. Everyone in Idaho has a chili recipe. There are competitions for it. I can't say that I've ever won any prizes for this, but a lot of people like it. And I've gotten a lot of comments over the year. The publication this year was the 12th time I publish it annually that I've published it. And the basic reason that I published it is that by Saturday morning, Thanksgiving weekend, you are literally fed up with turkey. So you want something different. And I always felt that chili was just the thing. So developed this recipe over the years. People have provided ideas. I've added a few vegetables. Cooking with beer is a major important aspect of it. And getting some of the vegetables in there and sauteing them just right so they're sweet and not bitter. And then just the right amount of heat. You know, the interesting metaphor here is that the railhead that goes to the Idaho National Lab from Blackfoot, Idaho, which is where the Union Pacific Spur comes up from Salt Lake City, is called Scoville. Now, the interesting thing is that the way you measure heat in terms of red pepper, which of course goes in chili, is the Scoville scale. So this was sort of interesting juxtaposition of the word Scoville. I decided that, Idaho nuclear chili would be the way to go. Now, the chili recipe, it's very clear that you would season this to taste. And just because it's called nuclear chili doesn't mean that it's going to be, white hot in terms of its impact on your taste buds. It simply means that's the legacy of where it came from. It came from a nuclear engineering site, which is where it was developed, and where it was first cooked. So that's kind of the legacy.
Love it. Great contribution. And I'm sure it's delicious. Let's now pivot to the nuclear conversation, and especially to your international experience. Energy is a global issue, and I'm sure our listeners would love to get a feel for your various types of projects around the globe. And if you can share with us the customs and perceptions you encountered in various countries and how these may contrast with the attitudes of nuclear here in the United States.
Well, I'm going to cover a couple of different countries. I'm going to talk about Japan, France, South Korea, and then the UK as four examples, because they're very, very different perspectives. If you say Japan and nuclear, first thing that comes to people's mind is Fukushima, because of the terrible tsunami and earthquake that devastated that part of the island in March of 2011, and the nuclear reactor problems that were generated by that. But that being said, the result of that is that Japan now imports about 90% of its nuclear, of its energy requirements, because it shut down all of its reactors following the Fukushima crisis in order to do safety reviews. It's been slowly restarting them. Up until 2011, Japan generated about 30% of its electricity from reactors, and it was on track to take that number to 40% by 2017. Fukushima brought all that to an end. Since then, some reactors have restarted, and the plan now is by 2030 to get back up to about 20%. There are 37 reactors out of almost 50 that were originally on the island that are operable, and the first two were restarted in October 2015. Seven more have been restarted since then, and there are another 17 that are in the process of approval. Process, and most of them will probably make it over a period of time. It's very slow going, because one of the things that's unique to Japan in its culture is that local, provincial, political elected officials have a say over the restart of the reactors. The community has to buy in. And there are a couple of places where anti-nuclear sentiment is particularly strong. One in particular is a province where there are seven nuclear reactors that are shut down. And every provincial governor who's been elected in that province since 2011 has been swept into office on a wave of anti-nuclear fervor. Whether those seven units will ever be restarted is a good question. TEPCO, which is the utility there, is hoping to restart the two most the two newest reactors, and they may have a shot at that. The other thing about Japan that's important to note since Fukushima is they've more or less, whether they like it or not, have de facto gotten out of the export business. As you know, Toshiba sold off its stake in Westinghouse, and Hitachi withdrew from the UK's Moorsight project because they couldn't come to terms over costs. And Mitsubishi pulled out of Turkey's Sinop project. And then a few years ago, Vietnam canceled the plan for Japanese firms to build four reactors there. So Japan's export business has contracted very significantly. Whether they're going to rebuild it or how they're going to rebuild it remains to be seen. Shifting to France, France, as you know, gets about three quarters of its electricity from nuclear energy. But the government, successive governments, I might add, have established a policy of reducing this to 50% by 2035. And they've backed off of that a little bit because they don't have an alternative. The alternative would be coal. They don't have large deposits of natural gas. They'd have to buy it from somebody. They now know that nuclear energy is as a core competence, if you will, of the economy, is something that they have to keep around. That said, what's going on now is that the French state-owned corporation, EDF, which took over from Areva, is completing two first-of-a-kind 1,600-megawatt pressurized water reactors, or PWRs, one in Finland and the other in France. As first-of-a-kind units, they are over budget and behind the curve. And EDF knows if they're going to build any more of them, they have to deliver on time and within budget. And they have proposed to the French government, because they are state-owned, to build six of these units between now and 2050, and to bring them in at cost and on schedule. Export-wise, EDF did complete two of these 1,600-megawatt units in China. Those units are now operational and in revenue service. However, plans to build six more of these in India have stalled, primarily NPCIL, which is the Indian state-owned nuclear power corporation, has balked at the cost and instead has committed to building 700-megawatt CANDU-type reactors. Heavy water reactors, that is, because they don't require reactor pressure vessels, and the Indian heavy industries can fabricate all the components locally. So I think it would be dim prospects, I think, for EDF to ever build those six units in India. But the Indian corporation is going ahead with the 700-megawatt indigenous units, and I think they will build at least 10 of them over the next decade. South Korea is a mix. Bag. They have 24 reactors that provide one-third of South Korea's electricity. It's one of the world's most prominent nuclear energy country, and it's been successful with exports. It's currently building four nuclear reactors in the United Arab Emirates under a $20 billion contract. The interesting thing about this is the contract didn't have coattails because the UAE contracted with the Russian Nuclear Fuel Corporation for fuel for the plants, and they didn't go back to South Korea for it. There's also an ongoing debate in South Korea over the future of nuclear energy domestically. The current president, elected in 2017, has proposed to phase out nuclear energy over the next 45 years. Of course, he'll be long gone by the time that deadline comes around. And the project has not, that plan has not gone smoothly because there is a lot of support for nuclear energy because it generates a lot of jobs. There's a huge supply chain in South Korea for the nuclear industry. There's a lot of jobs associated with it. You take away the industry, you're taking away those jobs. So remains to be seen how well the anti-nuclear policy will work out or whether a future administration will say, nope, we're going to stay with nuclear. Have to see. South Korea wants to develop advanced reactors. They also have been working with Saudi Arabia on a so-called smart reactor, a 300-megawatt small modular reactor that the Saudis proposed to build and deploy for desalinization of water that may come to pass at some point in the future. They also would like to get involved in reprocessing their fuel, but the U.S. has balked at that plan because it's not compatible with the 123 agreement that South Korea has with the U.S. under the Atomic Energy Act. That's still to be negotiated. The door is open, but I'm not sure that any progress is being made there. The U.K. has 15 reactors generating around 21% of its electricity. But the main thing that the U.K. is facing is two major challenges. The first is about half of these reactors will reach the end of their service lives in about 6 years. And the other is, for a number of long time, the UK has been depending on oil and gas from the North Sea. Eventually, that resource runs out. So the UK has gone back to nuclear and has a plan, which has had some difficulty getting launched, to build 16 reactors, approximately for around 19 gigawatts of electricity over the next several decades. The problem has been funding that vision. The first two reactors are EDF is building 1,600-megawatt units at Hinkley Point. That's underway. Ground is broken. Concrete's been poured. And they're on their way to getting those two reactors built. But several other projects have been stalled because the UK didn't have a good way of doing two things. First, figuring out how to de-risk the project financially. And second, how to get the money to pay for them. Which is why Hitachi walked away from the Moorside project, which originally was going to be built by another company. The net of all this is that the UK is coming back with a new financial plan, that they've used for other large infrastructure projects. And they're thinking that this might provide certainty for a company building the reactors, that they would be fully funded, and that they wouldn't lose their shirts in the process of either building or running the plant. And hopefully, if that plan is approved by the government, it'll bring back Moorside and a number of other projects and get going. The UK is also starting to look at small modular reactors. Rolls-Royce just announced they're going to build a mid-sized reactor, much larger than SMRs. But a number of other firms have gone over there, including the U.S. NuScale has opened an office in the UK, hoping to sell their 50-megawatt SMR there. So, and that may be a cost-effective solution for some parts of the UK, is build these out 50 or 60 megawatts at a time rather than building 1,000 megawatts at one time. But the UK is still committed to nuclear, and they really don't have a choice because they're losing their other capacity, so they're going forward. That's kind of a quick look at some of the highlights in the international area.
Dan, I'm going to go back to your recipe and maybe make a bit of a stretch of an analogy here. Yeah, so while Idaho Nuclear has its chili, I'd like to imagine each of those other countries you talked about have their own legendary recipes within the nuclear industry, but of course different cultures and different peoples have their own unique taste buds. So the analogy I'll make is similarly, different cultures might have their own attitudes towards nuclear energy. And so you gave us a good overview there of the differences among those select nations in policymaking and in the utility industry when it comes to nuclear. But as you seek to dispel, information or fear about nuclear energy to the public, is there any way in which those different nations' cultures perhaps come into play?
I think so. First of all, government support, it needs to be steady across administrations. The nuclear industry, to build a reactor from the day you say, let's go, to the day it's in revenue service, probably exceeds the election cycle of any of these countries in terms of prime ministers or presidents or parliaments or congresses. And the thing that the nuclear industry probably makes them the most nervous is that you get these sudden swings in policy about nuclear. And meanwhile, you got billions of dollars invested in a project. All of a sudden, the government turns it into a white elephant. So you've got to have a steady commitment. A few years ago at the Idaho National Lab, John Grossenbacher, who was the director, his former Navy admiral, and knows something about nuclear submarines and nuclear energy in general, said that nuclear energy is a 100-year proposition. And if you think about it, he's right, because right now, a couple of nuclear reactors in the United States are going in for a new round of license renewals, which will take their service lives to 80 years. And this is clearly within his idea of it. So if you're building a nuclear power plant in the UK right now, you have a minimum 60-year service life for that. It's 2019 right now. You're talking 2079 when you get to the decision of whether or not you're going to go for the 20 years. And now you're at 2099 when you're ready to decommission. That's a 100-year cycle. And you need... We don't think in those kinds of terms as Western civilization, and we probably need to, because this is the whole concept of sustainability. If you're going to decarbonize both the electricity sector and the process heat sector by 2050 or thereabouts, you have to have this kind of long-range thinking, and the government has to commit to it. The second thing you need is financing. You need financial mechanisms that don't rely entirely on the private sector. The private sector just cannot mobilize the kind of money that you need to build these things, either 50 megawatts at a time or 1,000 megawatts at a time. The government needs to backstop it with two things. First of all, loan guarantees. And the second thing is rate guarantees. Because once you build it, you've got to be able to sell the electricity and not be undercut by wild swings in a merchant environment. So those are the fundamental success factors that go across any of these countries. They all have that in common.
Dan, to keep the conversation going further regarding this topic, this specific topic, I'm going to serve as the contrarian here. If each country invested in upgrading its transmission and distribution lines and put more attention behind the renewable market energy mix, is there really a future for nuclear? And where do you stand on that?
Well, absolutely, there's a future for nuclear, because the number one thing as a grid operator you want is to keep your grid stable. The problem is, when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, there's no electricity coming from those plants. So what do you do to keep the lines up? Well, you need what is called baseload power, and that's what you get from a gas plant or a coal plant, and you also get it from a nuclear power plant. So there's an obvious opportunity for partnerships between the nuclear industry and the solar and wind industry, and even co-location of plants, because if you're going to put in a switch station for a nuclear power plant, why not put solar and wind next to it to take advantage of the same grid infrastructure? So that's number one. Number two, a lot of people want to know if nuclear power plants can do load following the way gas plants are. Well, yes and no. It depends on the design of the reactor. But there's another way for that reactor to utilize being run at 100% of capacity, and that's to generate hydrogen. Hydrogen, I think, is going to be the fuel of the decarbonization cycle, because when you burn it, you get water vapor. You don't get CO2. And I foresee a future where, for instance, the transportation sector might be changed as a result of hybrid vehicles that burn hydrogen the way hybrid vehicles burn gasoline today. And then that moves forward, powers a generator, which turns charges a battery, and then you stop burning the hydrogen. Of course, we have to do a lot with fueling infrastructure and design and a whole lot of other things. But basically, you can get a lot of hydrogen from a nuclear reactor, and all that electricity can be used and that heat can be used to generate it. If solar and wind are on the grid, you don't need as much juice coming from the reactor. And so you can divert its power to making hydrogen. So it's a natural partnership in two ways. The first is where the reactor could do load following. Of course, that's a partnership on the grid. And the second thing is where it's more feasible to shift the reactor's power to doing something else, making process heat or hydrogen or other possibilities like desalinization, because the grid is now being fed by renewables. That's a partnership, too. So there's plenty of win-win opportunities out there.
It's been my understanding that integrated molten salt reactors, although not a new technology, in fact, I believe it dates back to the 1960s and is one that runs on a small scale at Oak Ridge National Lab. This is garnering more media attention. I believe that Bill Gates and others have invested in this this technology. Can you explain to our listeners what is a molten salt reactor, and could this be a possibility of the future?
Yes, it can be. Molten salt was originally developed at the Oak Ridge National Lab, and reactors were run successfully using this technology there in the 50s and 60s. A molten salt reactor involves taking a salt solution, either chloride or fluoride, lithium's also sometimes in the mix, the fuel, usually you, at this point, the preferred fuel is a uranium fuel. Low enriched fuel that is less than 20% U-235 is in the salt itself. You use basically, you're still going to have control rods to mediate the reaction, but the primary loop is liquid fuel salt. That primary loop, in turn, has embedded in it a secondary coolant loop, which is not radioactive, which then transfers the heat from, there's no contact, by the way, between the primary salt and the secondary loop. They're isolated from each other physically in terms of the way the piping is done. So that transfers the heat out of the reactor to turbines, which can in turn do one or two things. You can either make steam, which is kind of old school, or you could have an industrial solar salt loop running at around 600 degrees C, which could drive power generation, could drive thermal storage, or could drive process heat. And a number of the developers like Terrestrial Energy and also the molten chloride reactor being developed by TerraPower involve all three outputs from it. The second kind of molten salt reactor doesn't have molten salt in the primary reactor pressure vessel. The primary reactor vessel is a high-temperature gas-cooled reactor using TRISO fuel. Those are otherwise known as a pebble bed reactor. The helium is the primary gas that's inside of it. That comes out of the reactor, goes to a secondary loop of salt, and the salt is a very effective heat transfer mechanism. Again, the solar salt that you see at some of the solar installations. It's a very effective heat transfer mechanism. And that in turn drives the kinds of outputs that I mentioned earlier, which is power generation, thermal storage, and process heat. So you have two different approaches to it. By the way, although I have no relationship with Terrestrial Energy, their website has some great graphics on it. And if you want to see how one of these things work, just go on over there and take a look.
Well, I'm fully confident that this conversation will continue on Energy Central, and as well as the chili recipe that you had posted. Dan, I really want to thank you, and on behalf of all of Energy Central, I want to thank you for your generous time and insight today. Dan, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to reach you?
Let's see. I have a Twitter feed with my name on it. My blog, if you go to my blog under the About tag on the main menu, there's contact information there. And all you have to do is click on it, and you get an email address or phone number. So if you have a question or a comment, happy to hear either.
That sounds great, Dan. Thank you very much. In our next podcast, we will go water skiing with Winston Churchill. No, not exactly, but this headline by Lincoln Blevins, Assistant General Manager of Power Supply for Burbank Water and Power, captured lots of attention. Hear Lincoln critique leadership at our utilities. It'll be great, and you won't get wet. I also wanted to thank the following contributing partners of Energy Central. ESRI, the Environmental System Research Institute. ESRI is the international supplier of geographic information system software, WebGIS, and geodatabase management applications. To Navigant Research, a premier market research and advisory firm covering the global energy transformation. To Oracle Utilities, providing best-in-class utilities management solutions to improve reliability, service, and safety for electric, water, and natural gas companies. Atonix Digital, a Black & Veatch company. Atonix Digital software helps companies simplify asset performance management by putting data to work. And lastly, Bentley Systems is a software development company that supports the professional needs of those responsible for creating and managing the world's infrastructure, including roads, bridges, airports, skyscrapers, industrial and power plants, as well as utility networks. Once again, I'm your host, Jason Price, along with my colleague, Matt Chester. Stay plugged into the discussion by joining the community at energycentral.com, and see you next time on the podcast at Energy Central Insights.